Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keen On, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is Monday, April the 15th, 2024. Interesting times in America politically. We live, in my view, in what we might think of as Pareto times. The great Italian sociologist, Vilfredo Pareto, not always very popular because of his ambivalence towards Mussolini, but one of the great geniuses, at least in sociological terms. His book, The Rise and Fall of Elites, takes a little bit of Marx, a little bit of Tocqueville, a little bit of Weber, and analyzes the world in terms of elites. And that, I think, is an appropriate analysis of American, the current situation in America. I'm also reading Peter Turchin's End Times, Elites, Counter-Elites, and the Path of Political Disintegration. And there's more and more chatter, perhaps amongst American elites, about their irresponsibility or inactivity. And my guest today has a book, indeed, about American elites and their betrayal of the American working class, both men and women. Bacha Angasagan works at Newsweek. She, I think, is the assistant editor over there, and she has this new book out, Second Class, and she's joining us. Bacha, where are you at the moment?
I'm in Brooklyn. Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations. The geography of the elite. Isn't that one of the elite centers in the new America?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Are you familiar with Pareto and his theory of elites?
No, but now I feel like I probably should have read his book instead of writing mine, because it sounds very apt.
Well, I don't know if he could write about the 2020s in America. So you argue that the elites in America have betrayed the American working class, which is a return, of course, to theories of class. Pareto was very much influenced by Marx. He was a man, in some senses, of the left. Tell me your theory. What's happening in America? Who are the elites in America, and who are the workers?
So it seems clear from the data that while Americans are not actually very polarized politically on right versus left, we're not actually very polarized or divided along racial lines anymore, thank God. But there is a dividing line in America today, and it is the class divide that separates out the college educated from people who work in jobs that don't require a college degree. Increasingly, if you have a college degree in America, you will make, on average, $1 million more throughout the course of your career than somebody who doesn't have a degree. You will live longer, you will be much healthier, and you will live a life that is protected from the kinds of downward mobility and deaths of despair that are absolutely plaguing working class life today. And that divide is crucial, because you cannot have a stable democracy without a thriving middle class. And what we've had in America over the last 50 years is a middle class squeeze. And so a lot of people have been squeezed up to the top. The top 20% now controls more than 50% of the GDP in America. But then also a lot of people have been squeezed downwards, and people who work in working class jobs, who work very, very hard, jobs that once upon a time, as recently as the 70s, secured a middle class life in the American dream, they no longer do. And these people work really hard, and yet their lives are characterized by a lot of precariousness. And so that's really why I wrote the book, to flesh out who is the American working class and what are the impediments to them achieving the American dream in 2024.
Yeah, coming back to Pareto, I know you haven't read him. His theory of history is rooted in elites. Who were the elites in the 50s and 60s and 70s when the American middle class was stronger? Is your analysis that these elites were more responsible, or simply that they benefited from an accident of history where technology and the economy and economics and industrial economics enabled the creation and maintenance of a relatively strong industrial working middle class?
It is my view, based on the data, that, you know, in the 70s, for example, which, you know, 1971 was the high watermark for working class wages. If you compared a college professor to somebody who worked in, you know, an auto factory, they wouldn't have been making that much of a difference in terms of their income and their ability to secure the most modest version of, you know, the American dream would not have been different. Both of them would have been able to afford a car, a home, a retirement and dignity, and their children would have been, would have had more choices than they did. And what happened was, starting around the 70s and the 80s, but really turbocharged by Presidents Clinton, Obama, and Joe Biden, you essentially had more and more of the opportunities and the GDP being funneled into the knowledge industry. So people who were a cultural elite in the 70s, but not an economic elite, are now very much an economic elite. They're in that top 20%. By the elites I'm talking about, I mean, obviously rich people on both sides, but the people who have, who are really the kind of hoarders of the American dream, who created that policy that has funneled so much of the GDP into the knowledge industry, are very much the over-credentialed college elites, people with one degree, two degrees.
I don't know, Betty, I don't know how much a college professor earns, but I'm guessing the average college professor doesn't earn much more than, what, 100, 150,000. I'm not sure if they're, well, we can come back there. I'm not sure if they're the best example, at least in economic terms, of an American elite. Your reading of contemporary American history, I think, might be controversial. We've had many people on the show talking about what they would call the neoliberal revolution, began by Reagan, this embrace of unregulated markets. They would certainly argue that perhaps Clinton played a role in this in some ways, even Obama. But the inequalities in America are a reflection not of cultural politics, but of the neoliberalism, the radical shift in tax policy of the last 50 years, which was initiated by Republicans. Would you disagree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I would, because that's not how working class people see it.
So. But it doesn't matter how working class people see it. You have to look at the facts. It doesn't matter how they perceive it. What about the reality in economic terms?
I think they're right. I mean, I think the data shows that they're right. And that
you keep on, Batia, you keep on saying the data shows. I have to admit, every time someone comes on the show and they say the data shows, my suspicions are always raised. I mean, you can find data to make any argument. What is the argument to suggest that the Reagan tax reforms didn't fundamentally, for better or worse, I mean, some people think this is a good thing. It enabled enormous competitiveness and innovation. You never would have had the digital revolution without the Reagan tax reform. So I'm not suggesting it's a bad thing.
You mean, what is the data that it was things like NAFTA and not the Reagan reforms that sort of led to the stagnation of working class wages?
Well, this creation of an enormous inequality, you may be right about NAFTA, but there's also the reality of massive shifts. I mean, NAFTA has nothing to do with CEOs of car companies suddenly earning, you know, 1,000 times more than the workers, is it?
Well, okay, again, so the data shows that there over the last, so I'm hyper-focused on like what changed since the 1971, right? Like why did that high watermark for working class wages then start to decline? And if you compare today to then, the real shift in where the majority of the GDP is not in the 1%, it's in the top 20%. Mm. That's why I'm focused on that. There has not been that much of a shift in terms of the percentage of the GDP that is controlled by the billionaire class and working class people. I think this is why they're right. They don't see their interests as in tension with billionaires, who they often admire and see as jobs creators. They see them as in tension with the knowledge economy, which had a huge impact on how we structure our economy. So the offshoring of good manufacturing jobs, 5 million jobs that secured working class Americans with a middle class wage, and then it, you know, importing millions and millions of low wage workers from, you know, failed socialist countries to compete with the American working class, which obviously very clearly drove down the wages in the service industry, and then having this sort of free trade policy that resulted in, you know, much more competition globally in the among the global poor for jobs that used to be good American jobs. So those things seem very clearly to have had an impact on their lives, which, I mean, I don't know why you would discount. I think we probably care about the same things. We probably both want the working class to have, you know, a shot at the American dream, to have a stable life. The most hardworking Americans should be able to do their work and live in dignity. I'm going to assume that we both want that. I mean, why would you discount their view on that? People who are living on a shoestring budget are not often wrong about the economic policies that are good for them or bad for them, because the impact is so immediate and so disastrous.
Let's get back to this idea of the American dream. What is it in your view? And I know you've spent quite a lot of time in Second Class talking to quote unquote working class Americans. What is it for them? And is it different from the American dream peddled by this new elite of your argument is that the new American elite is one produced by our knowledge economy?
The most common definition of the American dream that I encounter doing these interviews over the course of a year was a home, the ability to retire in dignity, adequate health care, and more choices, or at least as many choices for your children as you had. That was sort of the definition I came across the most. And that's sort of, if you poll Americans and ask them, you know, how do you define the American dream? Most of them sort of include those issues. So, you know, retirement, a home, health care, and opportunities for your children.
We had the American economics writer David Leonhardt on the show. I'm not sure if you're familiar with his book. Ours was The Shining Future, The Story of the American Dream. I think in some ways he would probably agree with you. His argument is that the biggest problem happened in the 1960s with the split within the Democratic Party between the new left and then the unions, who were increasingly alienated by the politics of the new left. Do you agree with Leonhardt's argument?
I think it's funny because I view immigration as a really big piece of the puzzle. So if you take the graph of working class wages, which, you know, in real dollars has really dropped since the 70s, and you take the graph of the share of the United States, that is foreign born, in other words, that is immigrant, they go like this. I mean, so they're directly correlated. And so the unions, he's right that starting in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, the unions were very strong on immigration because they took a very strong stance in favor of the working class. But by the 90s, they did a sort of 180 on immigration and came to embrace illegal immigrants as American workers, who are, of course, a direct competition. And in that sense, to me, that moment is very crucial, because that's really when you start to see union membership start to fall. And I think that was sort of a disaster, because, of course, unions are so important for working class people.
Although less and less important. You wrote an interesting piece in Newsweek on this. It's a controversial, I'm guessing, quite controversial, that the title was from actually earlier, a couple of days ago. Organized labor in the New York Post, not Newsweek, organized labor paid the price for embracing illegal migrants. Why, and I'm curious, why did organized labor embrace illegal migrants? It's hard to understand. Why would they do that? And what's that got to do with your argument in elites? Because I'm assuming that the people running these unions are not really part of an American elite. They're different.
Well, the union leadership is often, you know, part college educated, multiple degreed. I mean, the leadership is very much at odds with the rank and file. So that's something that even union leaders themselves will talk about in moments of candor. The connection to the elites is that the elites are the consumers of low wage labor. And so, of course, they support an open border. It's very much in their economic interests, although they do tend to sort of dress up this economic interest in moral virtues and claim that economic migrants are actually refugees, which it's clear that they're not. So that's the connection there, is that as the Democrats stopped catering to the working class and really abandoned labor to cater to these college educated elites, they did a 180 on immigration, and they went from being the side that believed in strengthening the border to protect working class jobs, especially Black men, to being the side that advocated opening the border effectively, decriminalizing illegal border crossing. And the unions did that, made that move in lockstep with them. As to why they did that, honestly, I have not been able to come up with a good answer, because they're sort of reluctant to talk about it. There's a lot of denial about it. And then when they do talk about it, they simply will say, well, a worker is a worker. I think they thought that, you know, I mean, it was Reagan who gave 3 million illegal migrants amnesty. Maybe they thought that this was, you know, people were going to become citizens and therefore were going to, you know, swell their ranks. But I mean, it's the most obvious supply and demand. If you want to have higher working class wages, you have to limit the supply of workers. It's the only way to really do it in a free market. So I think it was a huge mistake.
Is your analysis of America, Batya, that the Democratic Party has become the party of the elites, and that most of your 20% of this new knowledge economy, the elites, the university professors, the lawyers, the doctors, the business people, the entrepreneurs, the think tank people, journalists like you and I, that they're all voting for the Democratic Party?
Okay, so the data shows that 9 of the 10 richest counties in America now go for the Democrats. 65% of Americans making more than $500,000 a year now vote for Democrats. 97% of money coming out of Silicon Valley goes to Democrats, and Wall Street gave more money to Joe Biden than to Donald Trump. This is not to say that the right doesn't have its version of this. The GOP is still the part, I'm not talking about Trump, put Trump aside, the GOP is still the party of tax cuts uber alles. That's all the donor class cares about, which is why they put so much money behind Nikki Haley. I mean, she outspent Trump 2-1 in the primary. So, you know, yes, the elites, the college educated tend to gravitate towards the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party now represents most of the rich people in America, especially that top 20%. But there's, of course, still rich people who vote for the Republicans in the hopes that the Republicans are going to be able to sort of drag the party away from Trump at some point and go back to catering only to corporations and only to the rich. Meanwhile, you know, the majority of working class Americans are sort of on the Trump train, and that includes now most Hispanic people, and Trump's polling very well with Black Americans, Black men specifically. We'll see what he ends up getting, but the polling suggests, you know, huge defection from the Democratic Party. So that trend, I don't want to say towards the Republicans, because it's not, but the trend away from the Democrats toward Trump is very real.
Yeah, it's a fascinating observation. And I have to admit, I don't, a lot of people will, of course, you know this better than I do. A lot of people will strongly disagree. I don't disagree with you on this. I live in San Francisco, along with New York and Brooklyn, the center of the new elite. And I did still have never met anyone who would admit to voting for Donald Trump. How does class consciousness work, Batya? Ever since Marx, we've had generations of sociologists and political theorists and philosophers trying to make sense of class consciousness. Does this new elite that you've identified, this knowledge elite, do they have a consciousness? Do they recognize, for example, that they're voting out of their own self-interest, or have they dressed this up in the ideology of selflessness?
So I can only tell you the answer to that.
Don't tell me about data. I don't want to hear any more data stuff. I want your opinion.
Well, I was going to say, I wrote a book about the working class. I didn't write a book about the elites. Although
no, I know, but it's they're bound together. It's fish and chips, and you can't do one without the other.
As a member of the elites, I can tell you, like, you know, socially what I've encountered. And yes, of course, thank you so much. My first book was a little more.
Your first book was Bad News on Woke Media. So you're familiar with these cultural battles. But I'm curious, where does, and we can talk about this in terms of the workers as well, where does class consciousness come from? Does it depend on the kind of wine or beer or fast food you eat, or what you watch on television, or what you don't watch, or the car you drive, or the sex you do or don't do, or the gendered identity you have or don't have?
In my first book, I was very generous with the elites because I was hoping to have an impact. And I sort of wrote the book as if they are, you know, all of these views that I view as class warfare on the working class really did stem from the best of intentions. I just made the argument as though that were the case, you know, as I try to come into every argument, you know, just assuming the best intentions in the person that I'm arguing with, as I'm doing right now. So I think that, for, you know, let's take immigration as a great example, right? Do they believe that they are, you know, morally obligated to welcome in any person who is coming from, you know, a poor country who wants a shot at the American dream? Does their heart bleed for these people? And do they feel morally, why shouldn't we let them all in? I think they do. But are they also benefiting economically from this mass migration? Is it literally putting money in their pockets at the same time? I think it is. And do I don't think they would be so wrong about the morals if it was not in their economic interest. So it's sort of more of a double consciousness argument. Working class Americans, their class consciousness comes from, they very much see themselves as separate from the elites and themselves irrespective of which party they vote for. So they're very unified. They really are not polarized. Polarization is like a totally elite phenomenon. They work with people and pray with people, and their kids go to school with people whose parents are all vote for different parties and have different, you know, political affiliations. It would never occur to them to hate somebody over something like that. They just don't have that luxury nor that desire. But they see the political parties themselves, the media, very much play, you know, as an elite that sets the agenda, which is contrary to their values, their belief system, and their economic interests.
You're not the first or the last, Batya, analyst to fetishize the working class, either on the left or the right. We'll talk about that after the break. I want to come to your analysis. As you say, that the heart of your book, Second Class, is about not the elites, but the working class, America's working men and women. So we'll come to that after the break. But I want to remind everyone that wonderful guests like Batya Angasangan are brought to us because of our friends at Liberties, excellent new quarterly journal of culture and politics put out of Washington, D.C. by fellow journalistic elites, but they do a great job. Going to run a short feature on Liberties, and then we'll be back with Batya to talk about the heart of her book, which are the working men and women of America. So don't go away, anyone.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
You can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We're speaking with Batya Angasangan, one of America's leading young journalists, has a fascinating new book out, enormously controversial, but I think interesting also. Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. Batya, you began by suggesting that the things went bad in America with NAFTA, and NAFTA, of course, was pioneered by Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. Wasn't NAFTA, though, in some ways good for the American working class? It enabled cheap goods.
You know, I don't think that cheap goods are a good substitute for, you know, home ownership and a retirement and the hallmarks of the American life. To me, the cheap goods really benefited the elites more than the working class. I mean, yeah, you can get a new flat screen TV every year for $70. But, you know, if you don't have a home to put it in, you know, what have you really gained? And, you know, we know that NAFTA was one of the number one contributing factors to Donald Trump's success in 2016. It was really, really devastating to the working class. And the things that were sacrificed in the name of cheap products, I think, mean a lot more than those things do. Yeah.
So this book, Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women, you went out and you spoke to a lot of the American working class. What did you hear?
I asked people if they felt they had a fair shot at the American dream or as working class people. And what they said to me again and again, what people would say, they knew people who had made it as working class people. They also knew people who were working poor, who had sort of fallen off, who, you know, whose lives were beset by the sort of deaths of despair that we're seeing in the working class. The most common view I heard was, you can still make it. It's not impossible to make it, but you can do everything right. You can make every correct decision. You could say no to every vice, and still it's a crapshoot. So it's still a 50-50. Maybe you'll get it and maybe you won't. I found that really the working class is divided into three tiers. There's a top tier of people who are homeowners, have a retirement fund, their kids are upwardly mobile, they're solidly middle class, have access to that American dream. There's also a bottom tier of people who are very poor, and yet they work and work and work, sometimes more than one job, sometimes more than two jobs, and constantly are having to call the electric company and beg forbearance, and, you know, it's just lives beset by total, total precariousness. And then there's sort of the middle tier, which is, I think, probably the most common in terms of the numbers. People who are making actually more wages than they did before the pandemic because of the labor crunch. However, they still are never going to be able to buy a home because of where they live. They have no savings for retirement. And often that's because of the exorbitant price of healthcare. So that was sort of the major breakdown that I found.
And how did that manifest itself in political terms? Your narrative is to, if there's such a thing as blame, to blame the Democrats for NAFTA. Is that in your conversations with America's working men and women, is that what you heard, that they blame Clinton and Obama and Biden?
The Democrats definitely have a branding problem. They definitely did. And including people who were working class people who vote for Democrats, they just felt that they were no longer a priority. People who lived in blue states and cities understood that the price of housing had become exorbitant and that that was why they were unable to buy homes. They weren't always, you know, as savvy as to, you know, the kinds of zoning laws and who, you know, who was enforcing those zoning laws and who was benefiting from it. But they were keenly aware of things like that. Immigration was a really big deal to them. They see immigration entirely in economic terms and were very apologetic for their views on the issue. They didn't want to be seen as not welcoming, but they very much felt that the, you know, exponential increase in immigrants had coincided with them not being able to afford the kinds of things that they felt that their parents could afford. You know, I will say there's one thing that they hated more than the Democratic Party, and it was the GOP. And that includes people who voted for Trump. I mean, they really hate the old version of the Republican Party that was basically just tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts for the rich, siding with corporations against them. Although the betrayal was less keenly felt because they didn't remember a time in which the Republicans had ever, you know, pretended to represent the working class.
What about the role of media here? As you said, you wrote a book a couple of years ago called Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. Is there a concern, and this certainly was articulated by David Leonard, it's one of the more controversial aspects of his book, that progressive Americans have become preoccupied with race and sexual and other aspects of identity politics, which has basically alienated the American working class?
It's complex. In Bad News, I argued that they were using this woke agenda to distract from their abandonment of labor. And under the guise of these new ideologies, things like NAFTA were enabled because if the media was still focused on the working class, they would have, you know, raised a real uproar. And instead, all of these policies were able to just be passed. So from that point of view, yes, there is a connection there, I would say. Working class people, their views on gender and race are really interesting. So very, very, very not racist, very clearly, you know, want to be living, to see ourselves as living in and want to achieve sort of the America that Dr. King described. But their views on sexuality and gender were really interesting. Almost everybody I met was like super pro-gay, and that includes the Christians that I met and interviewed, people who are like extremely religious, but have a gay person in their life who they want treated with love and respect and who they hoped would settle down and find love. They are very worried about the transgender ideology, especially as it pertains to schools and sports and young women. However, I would say that like these were not at the top of their list of preoccupations. Yeah, they don't listen to the media anymore because it's irrelevant to their lives. They are disgusted by the divisiveness that they see in the media. But I don't think anybody who would have, like, they would not have sacrificed a good economic agenda if the person was not on the same page as them when it came to transgender in sports. Like, the economic needs are so pressing right now that those were, I just came up so much more than, you know, the gender stuff or the cultural stuff. They really are not interested in politicians talking to them about cultural issues because the economic crisis is very extreme.
How sophisticated is their analysis of all this? That they may be critical of NAFTA, but what do they expect, to go back to pre-NAFTA, to go back to a system, a 20th century economic system, pre-globalization? In your conversations, did some of the people you talked to recognize that we're all casualties of history, that we all need to, especially workers in America, is that the whole history of the country over the last 250 years is to invent and reinvent oneself. It's a country of second chances because it's always had to be one, and that technology is changing everything for better or worse?
They understood that there were a lot of jobs that were, first of all, still here, still being done by them, and will always be done by someone. They just could not do them in dignity. And yet we as a society rely on them to do those jobs. So I think that felt very unfair to them. It's not that we're going back in time. They're still doing those same jobs. It's just that they can't now buy a home or afford to retire or afford to see the doctor. And that they're totally right about that, right? We are reshoring manufacturing. People are still building cars. They're just building them in China and having a middle-class life there. And so the idea that this is stuff that has been, you know, that it is in the dustbin of history is just not accurate. They know people are still doing these jobs. And so the question is just, can you expect to work really hard, physical labor, in jobs that a society relies on to survive, and have the most modest version of the American dream? Or are you supposed to just eat it and live a life of precariousness while doing a job that somebody whose job is much less important than yours but pays a lot more, they rely on you, they're sitting pretty, they have all of the benefits of the American dream, and you get nothing? Like, it just seems very unfair.
You've mentioned the precarious nature. Of course, there's a term now. We've done lots of shows on it, this new class, the precariat, which are the next chapter in the history of the proletariat, the traditional industrial working class. What are you suggesting, or what are they suggesting should change? Should you make companies like the new companies of the gig economy, companies like Uber, should they simply be made illegal? Should we do away with the precariat? Should we make being a member of the precariat somehow hard because of legislation, regulation?
I didn't interview any like unhappy Uber drivers. It's funny because the people who I interviewed who were the most satisfied with their work, it was often people you would not have expected. I spoke to a number of workers at Amazon who were very, very happy working there. So I didn't come away with the kind of, I know I read all these other books and I'm like, God, that sounds awful. But then when I sort of went out and tried to find people who would say the same thing, like Starbucks, you know, I spoke to a lot of baristas who really like that job and see it as a sort of stepping stone and one that has amazing benefits. They were going to college. Walmart is now hot, you know, 70% of managers are hired from, you know, the ranks of the hourlies, and you can now get a manager job at Walmart that pays $250,000 a year without a college degree. So I found very different than what I was expecting in many ways. There are some very obvious, totally nonpartisan policy changes we could make tomorrow that would make working class life immeasurably better. And, you know, I get these from them. I also spoke to a lot of experts, and then I would sort of bring what the experts said back to the people I'd interviewed and say, do you like this idea? Do you like that? Would this help you? Would this improve? And they would sort of improve on the ideas. But the ideas that had the most common purchase were, you know, controlling the border, just really radically limiting the number of immigrants that come into this country, both legal and illegal. Vocational training. We have a massive, massive dearth of skilled trades folks because Obama basically defunded the skilled trades in schools in order to sort of funnel that money to higher education. So we give about $200 billion a year to higher education and only a measly $1 billion to, you know, creating this real pathway to the American dream for the working class, getting rid of the diploma divide, making it illegal to use software that funnels out people who don't have a degree just randomly for jobs that don't require a degree, getting rid of these zoning laws that allow, you know, rich liberal couples to protect their home values and make it illegal to build duplexes so their cleaning lady could buy a starter home somewhere in the neighborhood. You know, all of this stuff would have an immediate and very direct impact.
Some of this sounds, though, a little bit like sort of talking points of the Republican Party. And it doesn't seem as if any of the things, at least you mentioned in those bullets, would bring factory jobs back, the car jobs that you mentioned in China or the manufacture of iPhones from China back to the United States. How would that happen?
Well, that already has started to happen. We are in a big, it started with Trump, and Biden has, to his credit, kept much of the Trump, you know, tariffs, for example, which was huge, huge deal to working class people. They bring up tariffs a lot. It's funny because I think the elites don't think about tariffs very much, but the tariffs on steel and aluminum protecting jobs that in right to work states pay an average of $88,000 a year, steel and aluminum. So these are people who are not unionized, right? You can imagine what they're making in the Midwest. That stuff is really important. Tariffs have a massive and direct impact on working class wages. Reshoring of manufacturing jobs. Trump put a lot of energy into that. He rewrote NAFTA. He turned it into basically the most, you know, pro-labor trade deal the United States has ever signed. 75% of every car that's imported into the United States has to be made by someone making at least $16 an hour. I mean, talk about, you know, reducing that gap. This stuff is all great. I mean, tax cuts for companies and corporations that are willing to bring work back here. I just don't think that we should accept that, you know, China's willingness to employ slaves in Xinjiang, you know, should be considered a competitive advantage. Like, I totally reject that. And you know, back in the 70s, you had a situation where working class Americans were creating products for working class Americans as consumers, which meant that the owners of these corporations had a big incentive to both keep the price somewhere where a working class person could afford a car or home or what have you, but also to pay their workers a living wage so that they could buy this car. That was at a time when the biggest sector of our economy was in manufacturing. And today the biggest sector of our economy is in finance. And obviously finance has a huge impact on, you know, when you have a company, a nursing home that's been sold to a corporation and then sold to another corporation, and each time all they're looking for is how to get, you know, the cost of what they feed the elderly down. I mean, this stuff is disgusting. I mean, at some point it becomes really ugly. So I think all of this is stuff that people brought up to me and mentioned. And, you know, I don't see why any of these ideas should be one side or the other. I mean, saying something's a Republican talking point doesn't mean it's not true. So I don't know why that should be a Republican idea, like protecting like the dignity of working class jobs. That used to be very much a Democratic view, but you're right, it's not anymore.
What about you? You've written a lot about foreign politics as well, and the world seems particularly anarchic this morning, given what's happening in the Middle East and, of course, in the Ukraine. What about the fear that a return to what you're clearly calling for, or what the American working men and women you spoke to, clearly calling for a return to economic nationalism, establishing stronger boundaries, borders for imports, taxes, tariffs? What about the concern that this might be returning the world to a more, I use this word carefully, precarious state when it comes to war?
I don't know. Things seemed pretty quiet under Trump. You know, we didn't have any wars. He was explicitly about economic nationalism. I don't think that's a slur. I don't see why we shouldn't want to take better care of our own people. And things were really quiet. In fact, he had some major, you know, peacemaking achievements. The reason that, you know, thousands of Israelis weren't killed the other night was in large part because of the Abraham Accords and these new peace accords that Donald Trump with his team of like know-nothings put together. It was kind of a slap in the face to the expert class. So I don't really see that as connected. You know, I will tell you, I didn't ask about Ukraine because it wasn't top of mind. This is a book about domestic policy. There wasn't one person who didn't bring it up on their own and say, I just don't understand why we're sending billions of dollars to Ukraine when we have so many problems here. And this was like both Republicans said that to me and Democrats. I mean, they just fundamentally didn't understand how that was fair.
Although I'm guessing they might say the same about Israel as well. And it's not clear how all the money going to Israel benefits Americans any more than the money being sent to Ukraine.
They didn't feel that way, but I mean, I understand why people say that, and you know.
Let's end with, I mean, you've talked about Trump. I mean, are you you sound, Batya, maybe I'm wrong, but you sound a very, lurking behind this is the shadow of Donald Trump. You sound like a strong Trump person. Are you suggesting that his was a very strong presidency and that it would be in the benefits of the American workers, the men and women you spoke to, America's working men and women, to return to Trump in the upcoming election?
Even the working class Democrats I interviewed admitted to me that Trump had put money in their pockets. I think that he, to me, sounds more like a kind of New Deal Democrat than anything else. His view on abortion, his view on immigration, his view on manufacturing, his view on gender and sexuality. He's very pro-gay. He's very pro-black. He's courting blacks. I mean, he seems like a kind of centrist to me in a way that is very appealing to most working class people who vote for him. They don't vote for him because they think he's an extremist. It's really the opposite.
I'm not sure or many African-Americans would agree with you that he might claim to be pro-black, but I don't think they see him in that way, do they?
Well, so consider that he's polling at 35% of black men. And if you think that in 2020, he was polling at 8% and he got 18%, you know, there's a limit on what percentage of black men are willing to admit they're going to vote for him. He's polling very well. And that's a factor of the economy. That is a factor of the economy. So I think, you know, I spoke to many, many working class people who felt that Donald Trump was very good for the economy and very good for them personally when it comes to economics.
Yeah, I'm not, as you can probably guess, a big Trump person, although I am. I have to admit, I'm rather amused by how much he offends the liberal elites. I find that rather amusing. Finally, let's end on the idea of elites, going back to Pareto and elite theory. Do the elites, in your view, Batya, have a contract with the people, with the working class? And might that contract need to be rewritten or redone?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I thank you for closing with that. I believe that we have broken the contract with the working class. There used to be this sense of noblesse oblige among the elites, you know, this sense of, wow, I'm so grateful to God that I'm making, you know, $400,000 a year and able to afford all the hallmarks of the American dream when so many are making less than that. Or even, let's say you said a college professor making $150,000 a year, which is, you know, more than double the median income. you know, I feel so grateful to God for this. How can I contribute back? And because of the meritocracy or the fiction of the meritocracy, these elites tend to think that, you know, they achieved this success based on their, you know, intelligence or hard work or what have you. And I find that to be, you know, spiritually, economically, morally, pretty offensive. I think we have broken the contract with the people who work the hardest and whose labor we rely on to survive, and that we should start respecting them again.
And are you seeing this aside from Trump? Are there other politicians you're seeing this acknowledgement and an attempt to rewrite, rebuild this contract?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few people in the GOP, although not enough. You know, it's going to be really hard keeping the GOP from going back to the pre-Trump era, the free market stuff. I think someone like Tim Ryan, who unfortunately, you know, was chased out of politics by the Democratic Party that didn't support him. He really cares about the working class, but so does J.D. Vance, who beat him in Ohio. He and Josh Hawley have been very pro-union, have been very supportive of that. So, you know, of course, there's people who get it. There are thinkers who get it on the left. Roy Teixeira is amazing. I mean, he really gets it.
Yeah, and he was on the show a couple of months ago.
Yeah, there are people who get it, and hopefully more and more.